For our COBT viewers, it's Maynard here with something super special at this year's CERA Week. Mike Wirth, the chairman and CEO of Chevron, has joined us for a great discussion, and we're just super, super happy to have him. Mike, welcome to COBT.
Thanks, Maynard. It's great to be here.
Well, Mike, it's never quiet in energy, but this week is CERA Week, and tell us what's going on before we jump in with Mike.
Yeah, I mean, really looking forward to hearing what Mike has to say. I'd say three things I wanted to talk about this week, three events really. You know, the first event is obviously CERA Week is this week. We're 2 days in. A lot of interesting things we'll talk about in a second. Second thing was the NVIDIA GTC conference was a big event that happened yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about that. And the third event is tomorrow is the FOMC rate decision. And so let's talk a little bit about CERA Week. You know, some of the themes we're hearing from CERA Week. You know, I'd say some of the themes are really, really heavy AI. A lot about talk about electricity load, really a lot of talk about hydrogen, a lot of talk about permitting. But I think what really surprised me is just the balance with the energy transition. A couple of years when we were back here, we're just so skewed to just, we've got to go to the renewables. It's been very balanced and people, you know, and that discussion's been frankly fantastic. You know, so that's that. On the GTC conference with NVIDIA, a lot of hyped up for this conference, obviously. You know, the CEO made a presentation, had his statements out there. They introduced a new chip. It's called a Blackwell. The amazing thing is this thing has 208 million transistors on a chip. Think about it, 208 million transistors. It retails for like $35,000 or $40,000 per chip. And so the thing I got from that is that's the next evolution of this company. That's going to be the next chip that goes in these data centers, and it's just going to sell crazy. And so I'm not going to comment about the valuation, but there was a lot of hype going into this meeting, for sure.
I noticed somebody called this NVIDIA Woodstock.
You know, and I know what I'd say with that is that, look, the stock didn't react, which, you know, there was a lot of hype going to it. But guess what? This isn't a second inning. This is an evolution, and it's also a revolution going on in AI. And the funny thing about it is that we heard that throughout CERA Week, and so I think it's real. The third thing we want to talk about is the FOMC meeting tomorrow. As all you know, guys know, CPI and PPI came out last week, very hot, PPI especially. And so most people think that the Fed is not going to raise rates. They're going to leave rates unchanged. The thing that everyone's looking to hear tomorrow is, what does Chairman Powell say? Is he more dovish or is he more hawkish? How many more rate cuts are expected this year? There's been no rate cuts, but there's three rate cuts expected this year. Is it two? Who knows? I think the market's going to have some volatility around that tomorrow. You know, last thing we really want to talk about is just commodities, crude oil in specific. Crude oil is above $80. It's around $83 today. It's the first time since November of 2023 that crude oil has closed above $80 per barrel. And the question is why? And there's three reasons why. One, you had crude oil inventories last week for the first time drew in the last 6 weeks. You're going to have refinery maintenance is going to continue to come unwound. And so what we expect over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks is that you're going to continue to see crude draws, and that's going to be helpful. The second thing, we were at the CERA conference yesterday, and the gun bar, you know, head of gun bar said that 600,000 barrels of capacity, refining capacity, has been knocked out of Russia because of Ukrainian drones, 600,000 barrels a day. That's supporting products over in Europe, especially diesel, and that's helping crude oil. You know, and so that's a positive. The one thing I don't want to, you know, and the last thing I don't want to say about that is WTI time spreads continue to just roof. They're going to steep backwardation. And I think what's happened here is that trader sentiment has been bearish up to this point. The longer we stay above $80, I think the more capacity that we're going to have those guys unwind. And the other thing we heard at CERA too is that most people were kind of bearish coming into the first part of this year for crude oil S&D. That seems to have changed to a more constructive stance, especially for some guys like the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. They talk more constructively in the second half. They may be talking in books, but it sounded really good. And guess what? Structuring WTI kind of supports that. And so to kind of wrap it up, what I'd say here is that, look, the thing that came across to me is CERA Week, it's not only about energy, it's about AI. All these things are coming to bear. And I think the thing that I took away is that the power needs that we're going to need are just going to be exponential. Base load that we're going to need for utilities is going to go up significantly, and we're underestimated. And the third thing is it's not all going to be powered with carbon-free energy. It's going to be powered by natural gas. And I think natural gas, we're underestimating what the demand is going to look like in the next 5, 6, 7 years. And I think energy in general, crude oil as well, I think we're underestimating what it's going to look like. I think people are very constructive. I think the energy needs of the world are going to keep going up. And so I think what you're going to see is, we talked about it last week and the weeks before this, I think we're going to see a revaluation of energy. Energy as a percent of the S&P is less than 5%. Cash flows are 10, 11, 12%. That's ridiculous. I think the energy transition is becoming, it's being communicated a little bit better. I think demand's going to go up more than people think. I think this AI evolution or revolution, as we call it, is going to basically be fantastic for energy. And I think what you're going to find out is technology guys, they really have been up against energy. I think they're going to be the biggest proponents of energy in the next couple of years. And so I think you're going to see that narrative change as well. So I think they're going to see multiple, expansion in the group. So, with that, I'm looking forward to hear what Mike has to say about the conference and about Chevron.
That was great, Mike. Thanks. Mike, thanks so much for visiting with us. It's really thrilling, honestly, to spend some time with you.
Good. It's great. It's great for me to sit down and spend a few minutes with you, Maynard.
Well, one thing I was thinking about is you've been doing energy for a long time. You've seen a lot of CIRA conferences, and you've certainly seen the ones in the last few years. We're 2 days in. What's the tone feel like to you, or what do you notice that's different, or what do you perceive about the energy conversation that's happening at CIRA that is kind of has a unique flavor this year, if you think it does?
Yeah, so there might be two observations I'd make. The first one is, this is happening in lots of conferences, there's a lot of AI.
Yeah.
Right? AI has all of a sudden become a big thing in all different dimensions. And what I'm seeing a lot of here is not only how AI will transform energy, as it will, I think, every other sector of the economy, but the power demands that come with it, the voracious appetite that these data centers have is something that I think people are only beginning to fully recognize, and what that means for electricity demand, in a country, in a world that already was striving to electrify more of its energy economy, and to do it with lower emitting sources, now has this new huge demand pull on it that will require not only more power, but also 24/7, 365 power. And the interesting thing, as I talk to some people in Silicon Valley and in the AI business, they talk about what they describe as a triple exponential. The first one being these models continue to just become much more powerful. Yeah. And as they train them up, they find they become even better than they thought they would be, which leads to the second thing, and that is an explosion of use cases. Initially, there were kind of fairly narrow use cases expected, and now the use cases are proliferating. And that leads to the third exponential, which is this demand for power. So I would say that's the new thing that I've seen here. The other thing that I think is to the credit of Dan Yergin and the organizers is CIRA is in some ways an allegory for the energy system. We talk about an energy transition, but the energy system has always been additive. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the beginning of time, when it was biomass and then coal, and we saw oil and gas and nuclear and hydro and wind and solar and all the other things, but you've never actually seen any of those sources of energy decline in terms of absolute demand. Mm-hmm. They may have declined as a percent of a much larger pie, but nothing's really gone down. Here, we were just talking, and you just add a new wing, add a new tract to the conference. And so 9,000 people this year, and we're seeing this kind of proliferation of different aspects of energy that become additive. And it's not that one has replaced the other. It's that we really need to be talking about all of them. So those would be my two reactions.
I was talking with one of the members of your team about, because you see conferences and get-togethers and convenings all around the world. Mm-hmm. And this is a CIRA conference where there's obviously a lot of, I heard the word sober a lot, right? Because people are practical and they're commercial and trying to figure things out. But I think the comment was, if you were having a conference in a different part of the world or with different constituents, the conversation would maybe be different. Because I think here at CIRA, it just feels like the world's getting a lot more sober and a lot more rational. But you probably shouldn't assume that that's going on globally? Like when you think about the other places you're going, like how does it feel in Washington or in Europe or in Asia? Do you have this same sense of realism creeping in? And that's my word, but that's...
It's interesting. You know, I'll contrast it to the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Okay, perfect.
Which has a lot of idealism. Mm-hmm. You know, the mission of WEF is, you know, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, it was kind of save the world, right? Make the world a better place.
Which and great, it's a very noble, global, you know, not that it isn't here, but it's...
But oftentimes very aspirational mm-hmm. And philosophical and, you know, what you see here in Houston at CERAWeek is a conference that's populated with engineers, mm-hmm. with scientists, with kind of pragmatic individuals who solve problems. And it's not that they don't have ambition and aspiration, but that's not where they tend to focus their conversations. It's about the technical challenges, about the economic challenges. It's mm-hmm. about the policy and regulatory challenges and how do we solve these. And so you use the term realistic. I think you do hear a lot of realism here. It's heard a little bit more of that, I think, in Davos this past year as well. But given the nature of this conference, I think it does draw a little bit of a different mm-hmm. Set of attendees that have a little more of that pragmatic view.
I think the other thing I was wondering about is if you contrasted some of the really large classic energy companies, if you went back 3-4 years ago and listen to what they would have been talking about then. Since then, not that it's only happened in the last 3 or 4 years, but since then, everybody's been looking hard at a lot of these other ideas. And so it seems like a little bit to me what's happening is people are reporting, hey, we've been looking at all these, and part of this, the sober theme has to do with having spent quite a lot of time over the last 3-4 years thinking hard at scale about these things. Is that fair?
I can only speak for our company, and we've been working hard on decarbonizing our existing oil and gas business. We've made a lot of progress on that. And I would say we've probably harvested a lot of the lower hanging fruit. And so what you face now are things that are more difficult. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've been growing our new energy businesses, be that renewable fuels, where we're kind of across the spectrum, renewable natural gas, renewable diesel, sustainable aviation fuel. We're working to build a hydrogen business, have a green hydrogen project under construction now, carbon capture and storage. We're working on geothermal. But what you find is that the laws of physics and thermodynamics and economics are stubborn.
Yes.
And when you're coming up against those and you're really trying to make progress, you see that the lessons that you learn apply and they have to be respected as you try to build these businesses. And it doesn't mean you reduce your ambition, but you become very realistic about what it's going to take. And I think we've learned that this is difficult. If these things were easy, they would have been done.
Yeah.
And the fact that they haven't been done doesn't mean they can't be or that they won't be. Yeah. But it means that they're not simple and easy, or they already would have been solved.
So I had a personal question for you. Just looking at your background, you were a Colorado grad and chemical engineer.
Correct.
And then you spent a lot of time in the downstream chemical part of Chevron. Mm-hmm. How do you think that affects your leadership style or how you think about projects or just how that informs your views or your analysis or your leadership of some of these areas?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I think that background has taught me. Number one is you have to have a customer. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember that customers buy our products because they enable some activity in their life, be it a transportation company, an aviation company, a retail consumer. They didn't get up in the morning and decide, well, I'm going to go buy a cargo of jet fuel. They've got an airline they're running, and they're offering a service to people, and they've got to fly their planes safely. They got to fly them on time. The bags got to show up. Fuel is their first or second largest cost. Fuel and people typically are. And so they're trying to run. So we have to meet them where their business is and where their needs are. And you know, it's a little bit the same thing as we watch what seems to be going on now with consumers and electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. Electric vehicles are a great solution for some people. Mm-hmm. They're not the perfect solution for everybody for a variety of reasons that I think are generally pretty well understood. And so a lot of the straight line extrapolation of growth and things like that is running into the same thing we saw 20 years ago when the Prius came out, and it looked like everybody was going to be driving a hybrid Prius at one point. And I remember talking to the people at Toyota who said, well, we're really worried that we're not going to be able to sell many more of these. And I was like, wow, they're just flying off the dealership lots. Why is that? They said, well, our data tells us that most everybody who wants a Prius now has a Prius.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing I learned is you got to remember there are customers out there and they make choices. I think the other thing that you learn in the downstream part of our business, which is very much a margin business, is margins tend to compress over time. And so mm-hmm. you can never assume that the good times will last. You can never assume high prices or high margins are with you because they tend to, you know, they disappear as quickly as they arrived. And so you always have to stay sharp on safety and reliability so that your assets are available. You've got to stay sharp on costs and capital discipline because that always matters. And I think it's a little bit different than sometimes what we've seen historically in our upstream business where high prices can kind of cover up for a lot of things that maybe you didn't execute quite so well.
I was hoping my upstream friends weren't going to be sour at me that I asked that question as sure. if they're not as focused on margins. But one question or observation, it seems like in the conference that you use the word customers, and a lot of people have referred to liking some many components of the IRA, hoping that those get implemented in a certain productive way, and then a number of people raising the question of who are my customers. It seems like the specifics of the IRA and how we implement it and the customers and long-term contracts, those two themes, regardless of what solution you're talking mm-hmm. about, seem mm-hmm. to be just big not problems, but just on people's minds.
I think you're right. I mean, I'll maybe just talk about two technologies that are, you know, subject to incentives in the IRA, hydrogen and carbon capture and storage. Hydrogen has different incentives based on what technology pathway, whether you're using electrolysis and renewable power, or whether you're using reforming of natural gas and carbon capture and storage. So they have inherently different cost structures. There are different incentives that are put forward in the IRA. And the reality is both of those will be more expensive than conventional hydrogen. And as we're looking to make investments right now, much like you went on an LNG project for a multi-billion-dollar investment, you're out there talking to customers. Are you willing to sign a contract? What are the terms? What's the pricing? What's the tenor? Mm-hmm. And even companies that have made bold net zero types of ambitions and publicly committed to them, think long and hard before they commit to increasing the cost of one of their important
inputs.
And locking it in. And until they do, it's very difficult for the investor to finance and make the capital commitment. And so you have legislation where you had bureaucrats who were well-intentioned and had some sort of analytical basis to put in place incentives at some level. Yeah. Running into the realities of a market that isn't beholden to that, but has got customers and got investment choices and alternatives. Same thing in carbon capture and storage, even a little bit different. Hydrogen's an established business today, so people can benchmark today's conventional hydrogen production and they know a price for it. Carbon capture and storage, really a brand new business. And so when you look at how do you allocate investment, risk, returns, and liability across a new value chain between the emitter, the transporter, and the storer of the CO2, and how do you do that in a long-term contract that's durable? You have pretty sophisticated entities that you're talking to, all of whom are very carefully thinking about signing any kind of a long-term agreement because there's not a business model that's been established. There's not contracts you can go by and say, this works, this has been tested and proven. And so notwithstanding the fact there are some incentives within the IRA that would say we can help the supply side of CCUS or the supply side of hydrogen, on the demand side, you've got to have a customer. And I think those are proving to be very real issues that are taking time to sort through.
But, you know, as you talk, I guess I am pausing on this approach of supply side stimulation, and there are difficulties. That's still, I think, a superior governmental approach than a mandate on the back end like we might see in Europe. Do you have any feelings about the IRA just, or, you know, versus other ways of doing this kind of conceptually?
Yeah, I mean, conceptually, the best way to do this would be with a price on carbon, mm-hmm. because that sends a market signal yeah. across the entire economy. And you let people make those decisions because there's a very clear and transparent price that applies across the entire economy. Politically, that's been really difficult.
And is that any better chance today than it was? Like, I can't tell, you know, how...
It's hard for me to handicap it. In the U.S. today, it's impossible to get anything done politically. So I think it's as difficult today as it's ever been. Europe seems to be a little further along. You've got certain jurisdictions that have, you know, tried to do this. So I don't think that the world should ever give up on that, because it's the most economically efficient way to send a price signal and then let the investments and demand sort itself out. I think second to that is something that creates some of these incentives to invest, which is what the IRA attempts to do. And then the least desirable policy approach is mandates, because those yeah. clearly don't work. And I think have a lot of unintended consequences.
So one quick question, because Chevron has been a great allocator of capital, right? And when you're in those meetings and you're looking at returns and one set of returns has a subsidy or a kicker or something associated mm-hmm. with the government, how do you assess that or risk that, or do you... is that just as good of a return as a non-subsidized return? I know it's not, yeah. but how do you think about subsidized returns and whether or not you should engage in that?
Yeah, it requires careful consideration and ultimately it's judgments. There's not a formula you can go by. I'll give you an example of a place where we've become more comfortable making these kinds of investments. It's biofuels. Mm-hmm. Early on, we were reluctant when the renewable fuel standard first passed in 2005 and then RFS2 in 2008, California low carbon fuel standard shortly thereafter. What's turned out to be the case is these are very durable policy tools. Renewable fuels have kind of strange bedfellows, right? Ag politics cut across mm-hmm. red and blue states. They have a very... kind of a unifying effect. Everybody loves their farmer. Yeah. And the idea of displacing fossil fuels with renewable fuels has got a lot of, has got a lot of political support. And so those are policies that in our judgment are pretty likely to remain in place. They are still subject to some volatile market effects based on bureaucratic action. So, you know, the value of renewable identification numbers has collapsed. The EPA has to set the renewable volume obligation every year, and that can affect the market for these things. And so you still have, you have some risk because it's an unnatural market. It's a market that was created by regulation, but it's a durable market. And so you can at least look at that and you can invest into that with some confidence that it won't go away. The IRA, on the other hand, many of the incentives in the IRA sunset in a decade. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be really careful about building a business or making an investment that may take you several years to permit, a few more years to construct, and then you might need to amortize that investment over two decades. That's not uncommon in our industry, those kinds of timelines. And the financial incentives may evaporate well before you get to the natural payout period mm-hmm. for your project. So we don't intend to make large, long-term strategic investment choices. And by that, I mean multiple facilities and really growing a business in something that is very dependent upon a subsidy that might go away. Mm-hmm. I understand why these are here. We'd like to see them help us make investments. Costs come down. But at some point, you really have to look at things on a level playing field mm-hmm. and an unsubsidized basis. So there's going to be more risk. You should expect a higher return out of something, or you should allocate less capital to it until you can de-risk it.
I was thinking when you mentioned renewable fuels, you bought the REGI business. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking the other thing I've seen you talk quite a lot about is you're big on culture. You care about how the place runs, how the place communicates, how the place treats each other, all that kind of stuff. I'm curious about culture and new energies and kind of classic energies, because sometimes I think there's you put things in boxes and suddenly you have all the new stuff over here and all the old stuff over here. Like Ford kind of did that. We've got engine and the, and that can be bad for morale and culture. Like, how do you integrate into your business all these different things you're looking at and keep everybody, like, we're all Team Chevron, even if we're slightly different flavors?
Well, it's a really important issue for us. First of all, you have to really be committed to your culture. Our culture is, the company's 145 years old. I can find the roots of our culture back a century ago in documents and practices and policies. And so you have to be very clear on what kind of culture you're trying to build as you integrate new people into that, be they new hires or people that join you as part of one of these transactions. You really want to make that an important part of coming together. We look at it, frankly, when we look at acquiring a company, we look at what their culture is and we map it against ours. And we've actually got that as part of the process. And we'll downscreen things where we think there's a cultural disconnect. In fact, there are attractive deals. We've said, well, I'm not sure we should do that because we don't think the cultures are ever going to be compatible enough. So it really matters. When you bring in something like New Energies, there's a risk that that becomes kind of the new glamorous place to be that everybody wants to work. And the traditional business, which is paying the bills, might be perceived as
less important.
Where's the future? Where's the past? You get these kinds of things. And we've really set up a model where our New Energies group is relatively small because we want to leverage the capabilities that we have in our technical center, that we have in our refining operations, that we have in our upstream business. And so our New Energies team doesn't build their own capacity in every dimension. They rely heavily on people that are in other segments of our business and they collaborate. So you really have to have, you know, we refer to it as one team. You have to have this mindset that we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And if we're trying to build a new hydrogen business with carbon capture and storage at a refinery, that's an important thing for the refinery. It's got to be important for New Energies. And we got to bring everybody together. And so you try not to let these internal identities grow so strong that you have different cultures or that you have people competing internally. But you really have to focus on that collaboration. But it requires a lot of work and it requires leaders to really step in and be sure that we keep people focused on the big goal.
So I feel like I should ask just because there's been a lot of consolidation going on in North America, and how you integrate is such an important part of whether or not it was a good deal. When you look back on some of your deals, is there a bit of a, what would you tell other executives who are out there thinking about what's a good way to integrate? What are some do's and don'ts? Like, what are, how do I really bring this thing together?
Number one, you know, we did our deal with Noble during a pandemic. We negotiated it, did the data room, we actually closed the deal during the pandemic while nobody's in the office, and brought the two companies together. I would not recommend doing that as a standard practice. I think we still have work.
Although Dave Stover says it went great, even though, you know, under the circumstances.
Well, I appreciate that. I live with it every day, and I see where it hasn't all been as smooth as it perhaps could have been. So we try to go into these things, and as I said, you think about it before the deal. When you first have your early integration meetings, you talk a lot about culture. And there's a risk that with a company that's larger like ours, integrating with a smaller company, that you, I describe it as we smother them with Chevron love. Mm-hmm. And the risk is what you do is you can suffocate some of the things you actually want to bring into your company to make your company better. With Noble Energy, just one example, and it's certainly not the only one. In the DJ Basin, they had a much lower carbon operating footprint than we have in our unconventional business. They had tankless field production facilities. They had flareless facilities. They had facilities that had really low, they'd been very smart about getting their carbon emissions down. And had we come in and said, here's the Chevron way of doing it, and this is, and you know, there are people who wait, look what we do. No, this is the Chevron culture, this is the Chevron design, the Chevron standard, we would have lost that. We're not taking the lessons from the DJ Basin into the Permian to reduce our carbon emissions. And so, you know, we're working on the Hess deal right now. Hess has had a lot of great exploration success. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm very excited about is to bring together talented people from their exploration team with the talented people in our exploration team and say, how do we become better? Not because we have a new portfolio, which I think will help, but because we got new ideas. We got different ways of thinking about doing things. And so you have to be very thoughtful in integrating, that you respect what I've seen over the course of my career, going back to the Gulf merger in the 80s and all those that have followed, one of the most enduring value drivers are the people that come in. But you have to welcome them. Mm-hmm. And then you do have to work towards this common culture, which has to be a blend of the two companies.
So you mentioned exploration. We find that fascinating because when you just kind of do a bit of a 10-year outlook and think about the world continues to grow, the world continues to have more and more energy needs, and whether it's the developed world and AI and some of these things we're talking about or the developing world, it just looks like a lot of need. And then when you kind of look at the oil and gas supply situation, you tend to think we will probably need to return to exploration or do more of it. Is that how you see it? What do you think happens, you know, out on the horizon in oil?
Yeah, so we really look at three different ways that we bring resource into our company. One is you explore and you find it where nobody knew it existed before. The second is you use technology to unlock a resource that you had, but you couldn't really economically recover. And then the third is you go out and acquire. We do all three of those. Over time, we need to be good at all three. In recent times, I'll call it the last 5 to 10 years, we've done more acquisition and we've done more with technology. Think shale and tight and the advances there. And we've pared back exploration activity a little bit. We've tried to high grade it. We've had successes in the deep water Gulf of Mexico and the Eastern Mediterranean. And so we've had discoveries, but we found more in the other places because there were a lot of opportunities there. Over time, we need to be a good explorer as well. And we're actually having discussions right now about what is it that we should do as we look out over that next 10 years, 20 years. Do we need to be in more frontier exploration place? Do we need to think differently about how we do our seismic work? How are we going to use big data and AI to give us a better batting average? I think exploration is going to be very, very important for our company and also for the industry for a long time to come.
So that second bucket you mentioned, the getting more out of what we have and sort of the shale or Permian example, do you think the next leg of shale innovation will come from, because we all grew up when it came from these smaller pioneer type companies, yeah. No pun intended. Now, though, we're going to apply AI, we're going to apply a lot of new science. Do you think the bigger companies will crack the code on the next leg of shale? Is that an advantage to some of these companies getting bigger in shale?
You know, it's probably going to sound like a biased answer since I work for a big company, but I do think we have moved largely, maybe not entirely, but largely past what I sometimes describe as brute force trial and error, where you drill longer laterals, you increase the size of your fracs, you change the spacing, you change the product. And what works, you do more of, and what doesn't work, you do less of. Mm-hmm. And so I think the industry's made a lot of progress by kind of empirical learning. We now have, you know, teams of people, scores, hundreds of people in labs working on all different aspects of geology, geophysics, rock mechanics, fracture technologies. How do you bring data and AI together to improve your ability to execute? You do what you do today, and also then how to predict better ways to do these things in the future. And so I do think organizations that have great technical depth are the ones that are likely to push those recoveries up to the next level. Mm-hmm. And we certainly would like to believe we're one of those companies. There are others out there that I have a lot of respect for that I expect will do some of the same things.
I was thinking when you we were talking about that, above ground risk has always been so important. And, yeah. You like the acreage. You tend to like it in places which are more stable. You're global. You're in a lot of places. You're in Kazakhstan. You're offshore Israel. You see it all. What do you think about the places we may be going, what are the desirable areas? What are the governments that are kind of going in the right direction and drawing capital? Or what do you just see on the map as you think about the geopolitics and where are good places to do business?
Well, we're sitting in the great state of Texas right now. There are not many places in the world that are any better than this in terms of above ground risk. And look, there are real above ground risks, right? We've had seismic activity in the Permian Basin. We have to pay attention to that. People don't want our activities to be creating earthquakes. So there's no place that is immune, but Texas is right at the front of the pack. You know, at any point in time, what I've seen over my 42 years is there are some places in the world where the pendulum is swinging in one direction, and there are some places where it's coming the other way. There's some places where it's reaching extreme, and you know it can't really go much further. You know, we've hung in Venezuela through thick and thin, and there's been a lot of thin. You know, time will tell how that ultimately plays out for us. But that's, you know, that's amongst the toughest places right now, because you've got sanctions against, you know, Venezuela from the U.S. government. You've seen a bunch of our competitors leave Russia for the same reason. But there are places that are trying to incentivize investment. You know, we're in Argentina. The current administration, I hope they are successful in advancing some of their reforms. It's a country that's got great natural resource wealth. Hard for us to step our investment up with all the uncertainty that we've seen there. But, you know, some of the things that President Milei has talked about and wants to do, I think would improve the investment climate a lot. We're in West Africa. And a few years ago, when President Lourenco came in, we saw significant reforms in Angola. And in Angola had really moved down the queue for us in terms of an attractive investment destination. They've reformed several different aspects of their policy environment to attract more investment. And so, you know, we see it around the world where, you know, we're in Israel right now as a result of the Noble acquisition. We've made some discoveries offshore Egypt. Egypt would like to incentivize more investment. And we see some encouraging things when I meet with the ministry over there. So, you know, it's a... You've got a portfolio. One of the ways we manage risk, geopolitical risk, is by not having too many eggs in any one basket and being pretty well distributed so that you're not overly exposed to a period of time in one of those countries where it becomes difficult.
Do you try as a portfolio to have a certain sense of like the cumulative risk of everything you're doing and somehow score that? And I mean, I don't know if that's how you think about it, but
We've looked at that over time. I mean, there are various kind of third-party risk scoring methodologies on any number of dimensions of risk. There are, you know, advisors on geopolitical risk, other types of risk. And you can do it in a course way as say that OECD countries would tend to have less risk than non-OECD. You can get much more granular and use a score from every country. You can synthesize those into, you know, an index or some other kind of a distribution and look at it. So we've done a lot of that work over time. And, you know, ultimately, you know, there's not a pure answer to this. It comes down to smart people that have worked around the world, that have good, deep relationships and understand how you assess risk critically through the lens of our industry, and then, you know, there's a lot of judgment involved, and that's segment risk. It's it's up downstream. It's all the different geopolitical risks, et cetera.
So I'm curious. We it seems like the energy security coupled with a transition thinking, the collision of those two is often more government involvement. We're in any place, but the West, we've certainly seen more government involvement in the energy sector broadly. Are you hopeful? Because I guess as a markets person, I'm thinking maybe that's too much and maybe we need to go back the other way. Is that the trend you see? And do you think we're going to continue on that trend? Or can we get back onto a more market-based trend in energy in the West?
It's actually one of the most powerful macro trends that we've been tracking now for a number of years. We first started talking about this several years ago as you saw more interventionist industrial policy in different parts of the world. And, you know, we're coming out of several decades of growth in trade, in reliance on markets, in flows of capital and people and technology around the world, and efficiency that has benefited the quality of living around the world as a result. And what we've seen now, and you can see it with Brexit, you can see it with populist politics in this country, you can see it with what's happening in China. And COVID exacerbated this, right? As people realize these highly efficient supply chains were also fragile. And so there is a belief on the part of many governments around the world that they should retrench to their own borders to a greater degree than they had, that they should insource production of all types of goods. And what that does is it tends to be inflationary. It may create more security around supply chains because there's more redundancy or there's more local control, but it foregoes the efficiency that we've seen over the last several decades. But it's a trend that to me still seems to be increasing rather than coming back the other way.
It's kind of funny. I was just sitting here thinking, to put it in personal terms, a home generator is inflationary. To do that, we understand why people do it. But do you think on the topic of inflation that when you start to add up things like insourcing, transition policies to more spending, some more expensive ways to do things, like does it feel like we're on an inflationary path that's going to be hard to get off to you?
I do think that
number of those. And you'd like to talk about labor. And labor is another one that's a big part of it.
I do think we've got a number of those trends that are likely to be stubbornly inflationary. Patrick Poirier from Total likes to talk about we're trying to build energy system B, which is the low carbon energy system, and go away from energy system A, which is one that runs the world today. Energy system B is 2% built. And so the analogy to your generator is, you're building a second home, right? Not just a second source of electricity, but you're worried that your home may not be durable, and so you're going to build a second home. So would you do that otherwise? No, you probably wouldn't. So you're going to have twice the housing cost. So there's no doubt that we're replacing the energy that runs the world today. We're trying to displace that. And so... but we can't turn the one off until the world's ready to run on the new one. And so that's inherently going to be more costly. We're coming out of a long period of time where money was essentially free.
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore. I do think, and then this kind of nationalistic return to industrial policy and all the other trends that we're seeing, we're just talking about, all of those tend to push costs up. And I do think that this isn't a comment on the Fed and the kind of the current environment in near term, but I think long term there are kind of structural inflationary dynamics that are working their way back into the global economy.
It sort of seems like, and these are my words, but it seems like that old focus on standard of living and lowering people's key living costs to make their lives better, we've lost a little bit of that focus, and that we need to get that back.
Has been replaced by sovereign concerns, populist politics, territorial protection and instincts. And the globalization is what drove the standard of living up and drove these costs down. And when you're in a deglobalization phase, you're going to see the reverse.
What would you say about the developing world? Because you see so much of the developing world and how people are just trying to get basic needs and grow their countries and economies. It seems like their voice has been, we haven't been listening as much as we should. We haven't been involving them as much as we should in some of these energy policy decisions. Do you feel like that's improving? What do you hear in the developing world when you visit with them?
Well, I think you're right, because when you say, are we listening to them, most of these discussions go on in
nice places.
Western Europe, in New York and Washington. They don't go on in Bangladesh and in sub-Saharan Africa and in developing Latin America, where what people want is clean water, reliable electricity, roads, sanitation, basic services, hospitals and medical care that improve infant mortality and life expectancy. And they want a better roof over their heads. They want a better future for their kids. And they're much less concerned about some of the things you hear about in these developed world discussions. My children have a way sometimes of be talking about something and say, oh, Daddy, that's a first world problem. It's kind of a flip young person's statement. But the reality is the developing world has their own set of issues. And we operate as a guest in the countries where we operate around the world. And we have to respect those and work with governments around the world to meet their priorities and their policy agenda. And I talk about the three things that matter most on energy. It's affordability, it's reliability, and then it's environmental impact and reducing that. And how those three things balance out is different in different parts of the world, and we have to respect that. And you can't decide that in the West and impose it on others. They need to set those priorities themselves.
Now, you were talking a little bit this morning about Chevron's recruiting and bringing more people to the company. A lot of young people are drawn to, I would like to solve the climate problem, mm-hmm. that's inspiring to them. Is it also inspiring to them, like, we're going to bring power and energy to a lot of places that don't have it? We're going to change villages that don't have clean water. Like, have you found that people are recognizing that can be part of your experience if you work at Chevron?
100%. It's so easy to stereotype any group, right? Big companies, young people,
yep.
whatever it may be. And
Texans, Californians.
Yeah. And the reality is there's a whole range of people out there. And we're talking earlier about the fact this industry attracts a lot of problem solvers and scientists and engineers. Mm-hmm. And they like to solve problems, mm-hmm. and they like to build things. And some of the new energy technology is very interesting and intriguing to a lot of the young people. But solving our core problems and challenges around the world and building things around the world is also exciting to young people. And we are, we're seeing our recruiting yields as high as they've ever been. And people are excited to get into this industry. And that's here in the U.S. where we're sitting today, but we hire people around the world. And it's even more the case in many of the other countries that are working their way up the development process.
Do you spend much time on campus? I think I was at a discussion here not too long ago, and somebody said the energy discussion on campus needs to be better. We need to have better ways to talk about it in a more holistic way. Do you find yourself visiting with universities or any of those types of places where young people are?
You know, it's been a few years since I've done that. I used to go to my alma mater at the University of Colorado on a pretty regular basis. I served on the advisory board for the engineering college. I'd meet with students every year. But with my new responsibilities, I've had to allocate my time a little bit differently. So I haven't been back there to do that. I have to say, back then, the climate issue was very motivating in Boulder. Mm-hmm. Today, it's, I'm sure, even more so.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I saw when I used to visit is the engineering students oftentimes would find my talks to them would be infiltrated by the students from other disciplines who weren't as interested in mechanical engineering or thermodynamics, but were more interested in social issues. And it could get a little bit confrontational or disruptive. And so I think, we'd need another podcast to talk about higher education and the opportunities probably in the U.S. for balance and tolerance of different points of view.
Yes.
But the short answer is no, I haven't been back on campus for a little while.
Well, we also might have to recruit Dion Sanders to that, just that kind of
Coach Prime.
Get Coach Prime involved here.
Coach Prime might bring everybody together. He's got a pretty powerful effect on people.
He's great. So, well, one thing at CIRA that has, of course, come up is people are asking about the Hess situation. And please, anything you would share on that. I've seen you answer it with Dan. But I think the question a lot of us look at it and ask is, gosh, how did we get here? We've got two of the leading companies in this kind of public discussion. What would you share with us about that?
Well, I'd say what I think I said earlier today, which is we think there's a transaction that's good for the shareholders of both companies. We think it's good for the country of Guyana, strengthens the development and partnership there. We think it's good for the U.S. and frankly good for the industry. We have been engaged in private and constructive conversations with the partners in the Stabroek Block for months, mm-hmm. in an effort to understand what their concerns were, understand their views on the contract, which in some instances are different than our views, and to try to help them achieve the objectives that they had articulated to mm-hmm. us. And as we were in that process, then we were surprised when a couple of weeks ago, we learned that they intended to terminate, they had terminated those discussions and had filed for arbitration. So, we did extensive diligence on the contract mm-hmm. Before we signed the agreement. We're very confident in our understanding of the contract language, and we look forward to seeing it affirmed in the arbitration.
Is there a way that those of us on the outside should think about where it goes from here, or how it plays out, or what the structure of the future of it looks like?
Well, we still fully expect to close the transaction. It looks like it'll take a little bit more time now because the arbitration may become the rate defining factor. We're working closely with the FTC to satisfy their concerns. There's no real overlap in the two portfolios. So there are no antitrust issues of any substance. So I think this is just, international arbitration will take some time. We're prepared for it. We look forward to, affirming our interpretation of the contract and closing the transaction.
And just one last question. It's probably hard to answer, but I just find it interesting. If you're a Washington, D.C. or the government of Guyana or players that, have an interest, is there a way for them to weigh in on it, or are they commenting on it, or how do you manage those constituents like that that are not a part of it, but view it as very relevant to them?
Yeah, there's certainly there's interest in Washington, D.C. and Guyana. You've got this border issue between Venezuela and Guyana, and so there's a lot of interest. I can't really comment on any of the conversations, but I'll just say I think many of the stakeholders would prefer to see issues like this resolved, so that what they view as the bigger issues are the ones that can be focused on.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, I think to have two leading companies kind of in a public discussion, that's like this is probably not good for industry at some level. We're all on the same team, but
yeah, I would rather not be in this position.
Sure.
But look, we're believe in the transaction, and we find ourselves where we find ourselves.
Well, you're very kind to answer those questions. I noticed in your background, you're on the U.S. Business Council, and I think one of the things we've all found interesting in the energy debate is when other businesses that are not really energy producers or not, they don't have a dog in the fight, lean in and say, hey, this is what we want. And is there anything you could share about the U.S. Business Council and how, in your experience, other businesses, non-energy businesses, are thinking about U.S. energy policies, weighing in, hoping for change, or just any sentiment there?
Yeah, I think what I would say in those discussions, companies are becoming more pragmatic to our earlier conversation and realistic. A lot of companies made net zero pledges of one form or another when that became a bit of a trend. And I'm not sure had really understood what they were signing up for. Mm-hmm. The definitions of scope one, scope two, scope three are fairly complex when you get down into the details. And then the costs, the maturity of the technologies, and what it really takes to get there are something that, and a lot of companies assumed, well, we'll do what we can, and then we'll just buy credits. And right now, I'm not sure the credit market is going to be large enough that everybody could buy the credits they might have assumed individually would be part of their pledge. So people are searching for more information. Mm-hmm. I think they view our industry as a source of truth and facts. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of companies that we do business with that are here. Microsoft was up on stage today. I saw Amazon in the room, the airlines, who are looking to us to say, help us find ways to decarbonize multiple aspects of our business, our power generation, our road transportation, our marine transportation, our aviation needs. And those are all segments that we supply to. And so they're looking for kind of new models of collaboration. And so there's a lot of interest. And I think there's a more well-informed understanding of some of the challenges that are faced, and an appreciation for the fact that our industry can help solve some of those.
I was talking to someone this weekend that they said, we need more sustainability groups at a lot of the Fortune 500 companies. We need more engineers in those groups just to kind of level set some of these plans we tend to make.
Well, again, I might
more engineers.
Might be biased, but as an engineer, I think engineers, I talk to young people sometimes and they say, oh, I don't know if I want to be an engineer. And I say, well, you engineers don't do engineering for their whole lives. Engineers do a lot of other things, but they've proven the ability to solve problems, to kind of rationally assess data, and an engineering background sets you up to do a lot of different things. And so I'm a big fan of more engineers. More engineers, fewer lawyers, maybe.
We'll work on that ratio. It's got to be helpful.
All due love for my legal team and all the lawyers that do great work for us.
Right. Well, just last thought, I guess you mentioned some of the tech companies, and they are on everybody's radar as like, because they've looked up and said, oh my gosh, we need a lot of power. Amazon did a transaction where they bought a data center, which is nuclear powered. As those companies move into taking care of their power needs, it seems like they might instinctively say, gosh, a big name like Chevron, that's a name I trust to help me with my power. And I have a lot of power needs. Powers is not your historical business, but how do you think about this power landscape and everything that's happening in power? And the other thing we've been talking about is ultimately this may draw a lot of natural gas back into the system. Is there a role for Chevron in all these power dynamics?
We have, we've looked hard at power. We've had some of our own power businesses over the years. One of the things that's led us to do is be fairly humble about understanding our capabilities and respecting those of large incumbent players. The power sector is, the incumbents have technical depth, they've got a regulatory expertise, they've got a different set of shareholders, and they're good at what they do. Yeah. And we have learned not to overestimate our ability to step into some other segment of the economy and fully appreciate what it takes to be successful there. And so we've generally said we're going to leverage our capabilities to develop lower carbon energy to supply a growing world. And our capabilities tend to be in the subsurface, in the process industries, in molecules rather than electrons. Mm-hmm. And while we have renewable power integrated in some of our business and cogeneration and other things, we run power plants, it's largely to support our own operations. And you never say never, because we could find ourselves in those businesses one day. But to this point, we've really seen ourselves as helping to collaborate with people in those value chains, supply them, and find ways to work together, but not necessarily step all the way into the power business.
Well, and I think about your performance over the last number of years, the part of the secret sauce has been knowing your lane and pretty much staying in it and doing well.
Yeah, and your lane can grow and it can shift a little bit over time, but fundamentally, you need to know what you're good at and also be honest about what you're not good at.
Oh, I have one last question. I promise you've been so generous with your time. We had a guy join us last week, Paul DeBar. He had been the Undersecretary of Science at the DOE in the Trump administration. He's now at the Hoover Institution. And he wrote this paper about America as an energy superpower. And he said, great capital markets, great oil and gas, great technology. He went into the litany of all the things that give America its current position. Do you think we're going to have that position 10 or 15 years out? It seems like it's a great position to have, but we're a little bit taking it for granted, and it's probably something we worry about. But how do you think about that characterization of America, and can we hold that?
I think we can. I completely agree. I haven't read his paper, but I sometimes talk about that topic. And our country is blessed with an abundance of natural resources. You look at oil, gas, coal, hydro, the agricultural basket for biofuels, the wind, the solar, uranium. You can go down the list, and this country is blessed with huge and abundant natural resources. And the rule of law, a great set of universities, a market-based economy, a tremendous innovation economy, and great companies, thousands of whom are represented here this week. And so I absolutely believe all of those things will lead this country to continue to be a super energy superpower. As I travel around the world, it is the envy of other countries, mm-hmm. that this country has all those things. And it's the curiosity sometimes. They say, why is it that your government seems more interested in impeding your energy progress as opposed to
everybody else talks their own book except us.
And I think the reality is because it's the biggest energy producer in the world, we're the biggest energy consumer in the world, we've been able to get away with being a little sloppy on policy because we have all these great companies and all these great resources. And so with more clear-minded and constant commitment on the energy policy side, we can be an even greater superpower. But I think 10 years from now, this country still is an energy superpower, absolutely.
Well, I want to wrap by thanking you for doing this, and thanking your team for helping us do this, but also just thanking you as a spokesperson for not just energy, but I think as a spokesperson for just good, reasonable, thoughtful approaches. And we see you go to Congress and go through some of that Q&A, and we see you appear at conferences. And everybody I know says I really appreciate Mike's efforts on behalf of all the rest of us. So.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's been a real honor and a privilege to represent all the great people at our company and all the great people in this industry. And every day I just wake up thankful that I have the opportunity to do that.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Maynard.
Yes, sir.